We'll be reading Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 to chapter 14, verse 31. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the Israelites swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people.
Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am Lord. So the Israelites did this. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, what have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services. So he had his chariots made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over them all. The Lord hardened the hearts of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Did we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. Moses answered the people, do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you need only to be still. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the waters so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so neither went near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He jammed the wheels of their chariots so that they had difficulty driving, and the Egyptians said, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen. The entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea, not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you. That was long. I'm not going to cover everything that we just talked about here, but I will, I'll just get started here. So earlier this last week, my family and I, who just read some of whom just read the story, went to the East Van Panto. Did anybody go to that this year? Yeah. Which was a retelling of West Side Story, but set on Commercial Drive. It was very funny. Of course, West Side Story, as they cleverly acknowledge in the East Van Panto, is a retelling of Romeo and Juliet set in Manhattan. And then Romeo and Juliet, like most of Shakespeare's plays, is itself a retelling of an earlier story called The Tragical History of Romeus and Juliet, which was a translation of a French tale, itself translated from an Italian novella. Which is to say, most good stories are worth telling more than once. Some even get turned into a musical, like West Side Story. And our story this week is certainly no different. We just read through the exciting narrative of the crossing of the Sea of Reeds, or the Red Sea, in Exodus 14. But if we kept reading, we'd see that the authors weren't content with telling the story just once. Chapter 15 retells the story again, and like West Side Story, this time it's a musical. We've lost the tune, but the words remain. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up, the floods stood up in a heap, the deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them, they sank like lead in the mighty waters. Now, the reason that it is retold so much is because it's a good story, but it's also foundational. This is the story that tells of the birth of a nation. And before this nation is born, or reborn in the crossing of the sea, they found themselves enslaved by the Egyptians. The story begins earlier than the enslavement, but there's good reason to believe that these particular people don't really know the earlier stories yet, or very well. They've been oppressed to the extent that their identifying stories had been taken away. Cultural genocide is a term that could be used to describe their situation. Their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, had personal relationships with Yahweh and trusted and worshiped Yahweh through their lives. Joseph trusted Yahweh during his own imprisonment and even led to his own success as an advisor, his relationship. But Egyptian empire was strong, and it was able to subjugate them. And they knew they were different from their oppressors as enslaved people, and they knew that they had a different god, but that is the extent of their knowledge as far as the story explains it. And so they cry out in their oppression, and as it says in Exodus 2, so several chapters before this, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Note that they don't cry out to God, but that God hears their cries in any case. It's just it's a cry for help, but it's not directed to anyone in particular. Nevertheless, it is God who hears the groans and remembers the covenant. Their pain is real, and their cries seem almost to be involuntary. God chooses to save them, though they may not even realize who it was who was doing the saving. The big thing in the way is the Pharaoh, who also does not know who this God is, and so does not believe that Yahweh is anything to be concerned with. When Moses comes to Pharaoh to ask for permission to take the Israelites to the wilderness for a feast honoring Yahweh, Pharaoh sees that as a threat to his power as a god and as a slave owner, believing himself to be divine. And so, as a way to secure the release of the enslaved Israelites, while also proving Yahweh's superiority over Pharaoh, Yahweh sends a series of plagues on the land of Egypt through Moses. And the plagues are familiar to many of us, the final one being the salvation of the Israelites' firstborn, which is commemorated every year during the Feast of the Passover, but which we retell every week in our communion. The night that Jesus was betrayed was during his celebration of the Passover. The 10th plague that leads to the birth of this nation during the crossing of the sea. Again, I was serious about this retelling of the story. The salvation of the Israelites during the Passover was the final straw for Pharaoh, seemingly, since they were saved from the death while the Egyptians were not. The death of the firstborn sons of Egypt proved that Pharaoh was not dealing with an everyday God, but the one true God who had control over nature. And so Pharaoh lets the people go, which leads to our story this morning. And there's a lot that happens in this very exciting story. The narrator explains the plans, which did not have to have the Israelites head straight for a body of water. They could have gone more northward, but instead, and ironically, they go through the wilderness toward the Sea of Reeds. And I say ironically because going north might lead them into battle against the Philistines, but going to the shores of a lake make them sitting ducks in a battle against the Egyptians, whom their God just decimated but not destroyed while they were eating their first Passover meal. It wouldn't have been a problem had Pharaoh not changed his mind, but he does. And in a moment that has inspired a lot of theological speculation and argument, God chooses to harden Pharaoh's heart so that Pharaoh believes that he can recapture his slaves in order to continue his building projects with free labor once again. Now again, this is not a fully committed people group. The Israelites don't really know who Yahweh is any more than the Egyptians or Pharaoh, presumably. I'm sure they're grateful of God's miracles. At the least, they would have given them hope that things might not always be as bad as it was under the thumb of the Egyptian Empire. But they are not convinced God can save them when facing an army with chariots and weapons. So, in avoiding a battle against one strong nation, the Philistines, they must now go to battle against another, but this time facing certain death. And so, they complain, while showing that they had not lost their sense of humor. Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? And so we have the confluence of two major patterns in Exodus. The hardening of Pharaoh's heart, which happened several times during the plagues, and again, very complicated, and I don't want to get into it. And the grumbling of the Israelites during difficult times in the wilderness. And this is the last of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, but the first of the grumbling of the Israelites against Yahweh's deliverance. But other patterns are established that go beyond the book of Exodus and the time in the wilderness. In the retelling of this story in Exodus, it's important to note that the crossing of the Sea of Reeds is, in a way, at least at this as this particular narrator tells it, a retelling of another seminal story in the history of Israel. Indeed, the history of the world. Though not a retelling in a technical sense, the story of God dividing waters of the sea echoes the creation of the universe told in the previous book of Genesis. Here's the Genesis account. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And then a few verses later, and God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And here's Exodus again. "The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. and the waters were divided, or perhaps gathered together. Though it's not a direct quote, the language echoes that of the creation of the universe and would have suggested a connection between these two seemingly disparate events. Here, a battle between the Israelites and the Egyptians, fought with a strong east wind blowing the waters back, gathering together the waters into walls of sea with dry land in between. Now, our Pew Bibles say that there was the Spirit of God hovering over the waters in Genesis, but as other translations put it, a wind from God was sweeping over the waters. Spirit, wind, and breath are all the same word in Hebrew, and it is that wind, spirit, breath of God that forms words in Genesis 1, commanding the waters to divide into sky and sea, and then gathered together to form sea and dry land. In that creation event, God brings order into a chaotic landscape, presenting the ideal peaceable kingdom. When the Israelites are grumbling about the chaotic situation they seem to be in, they had no idea that God was about to bring them out of chaos, reestablishing order to their world. But this is what this particular retelling of the story is doing. It is a declaration that the God who is saving them at that moment is the very same God who established the universe at the beginning of the world. And this should be a great aha moment for them. When this God called Yahweh turned the water into blood, brought plagues of frogs and gnats and thunder and hail and darkness, etc., it showed them that they were in the presence of a God who controlled nature. And that is because, as is evident now, Yahweh created nature. The division of the waters was done so that the Egyptians would know who Yahweh is, but it was also a declaration to the Israelites. When the Egyptians discover that Yahweh is fighting for the Israelites against Egypt in verse 25, their perspective as oppressors causes them to fail to see the division of waters as a creative act by Yahweh. This is bringing order to the universe as it did in that second day of creation, but the Egyptians see it as an act of war. Well, that's not terribly surprising. These moments in the scriptures, both the creation of the world and the plagues and the miracles in Egypt, are not merely chronicling events in history like a fly on the wall, but are clever ways of comparing the power of Yahweh over and against the impotence of other gods, which happen to be the gods of empires. And when God divides the waters in Genesis, this parodies the Mesopotamian god Marduk's battle with the goddess Tiamat. We won't need to go over that right now, but the big difference being that there are no other gods to battle when the Israelite God does the same thing. God just speaks, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered to one place," and it happens, and no swordplay is necessary. But here we see some resistance. Pharaoh refuses to let the Israelites go to worship Yahweh and claims not to know who Yahweh is. This arrogance is due to Pharaoh's belief in his own divinity. Pharaoh's refusal to accept that he was battling against a true God leads to disaster. According to Ezekiel 29, Pharaoh claims to have made the Nile River on his own. But this is folly. His overconfidence perhaps does not allow him to recognize the miracle at the Sea of Reeds, as extraordinary as it is. Or perhaps Pharaoh truly believes in his own divinity and so thinks he can control the waters like God. But the Bible is pretty clear that only God can control the waters, and that is that leads to the defeat of Pharaoh and his army. And so the division of the Sea of Reeds is not only a story that is retold several times in the Bible and every year during Passover. Not only has it been retold on film several times, including in a musical, in a way it retells a story from before, declaring that this God who delivered the Israelites from the bondage of slavery is the same God who created the universe. But there's more. For just as Exodus echoes the story in Genesis, the story in Exodus reverberates through the rest of Scripture all the way up until the New Testament. The obvious place is in the Last Supper during the celebration of Passover, but the writers of the New Testament also see the crossing of the sea as a baptism. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says of the Israelites in this story, "All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." And Paul's not alone among New Testament writers in seeing the crossing through the waters as a type of baptism. Mark seems to tie Jesus' baptism to the crossing through the sea as well. In fact, in some ways, Mark sees the initiation of Jesus' ministry as itself a retelling of this seminal story of Israel. Here's how he puts it. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And just as he was coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit, wind or breath, descending like a dove on him. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, the Beloved. With you I am well pleased." And the Spirit, or wind, immediately drove him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days. So it's no coincidence that Jesus comes out of the waters to wander in the wilderness for 40 units of time. For when the Israelites come out of the sea, they will be in the wilderness for 40 years. Jesus is identifying with the nation of Israel. But perhaps there's also something to be said about baptism in this identification. For one, we identify the God of our baptism with the God who created the universe and with the God who delivered the Israelites out of slavery. We also saw that the deliverance through the sea was compared to bringing order out of chaos. When God divides the waters to create dry land, it is declared good in comparison to what came before, the formless and void, the chaotic waters. Baptism not only declares one's allegiance to the God of creation, it's a creative act itself, putting things in their rightful place. But baptism isn't without risks. It is a salvific act, but it has its dangers. And that's because it's revolutionary. In fact, in all these related events involving the division of waters, there is somehow a struggle against imperial forces. The creation, I promise you I wrote this before yesterday, but I couldn't help but think about it a little bit. I didn't change too much, so. The creation narrative parodies the Babylonian myth told in the context of Israel's exile in Babylon. The deliverance through the sea comes at the defeat of the Egyptian Empire and its great pretender, Pharaoh. And Jesus' baptism is a defiant act against Caesar. The prologue of the Gospel of Mark parodies the Gospel of Caesar. Roman propaganda would often declare Caesar divine, much like Pharaoh. And news of Caesar's military victories were called Gospels, or Evangelion. In other words, the Gospel of Jesus is a challenge to Caesar, according to Ched Myers, commentator. It is a declaration of war upon the political culture of empire. And his baptism is Jesus' dying to the Roman imperial social order and rising again in a new created order of true peace and justice. The Israelites are pinned between the sea and the army of Pharaoh. Maybe they had it right when they grumbled. But despite the 10 miracles they already witnessed, they didn't yet know that the God they were on their way to worship was able to do the impossible. They didn't know yet that Yahweh is the God of resurrection. And they wouldn't for a while, but there are hints, including here at the Sea of Reeds. Facing certain death, God didn't just defeat their enemies, he brought them through their graves. The Israelites through their graves, walking down under the surface of the sea, only to be reborn as a new nation, but a new nation aligned with the original created order. At Jesus' baptism, we see something similar. Baptism isn't just a cleansing, it's a rebirth. Jesus' baptism in Mark foreshadows the climax of the story, his death and resurrection. And for us, our baptism is not merely a rite of passage, but an initiation into a new life. As we come out of the water, we are engrafted into this nation that got its start coming out of the waters, freed from slavery and oppression, and ready for the gift of God's law. I began this sermon talking about the East Van Panto and how most good stories are worth telling more than once. This is another way of thinking about our own baptism. We are retelling the stories of Israel, Jesus, and the church in total when we are baptized. In fact, it's a story that goes back to the beginning of the universe. Our baptism is related to the ordering of the universe, and it's worth retelling in its own right. My son Luke, like Elaine and Micah, has some fantastic godparents. His godfather, is an Episcopal priest and theologian named Jake, who writes Luke every year, not on the occasion of his birthday, but on the day of his baptism. Of course, Luke's birthday is worth celebrating, but his baptism is also worth celebrating and retelling. The story of the crossing of the sea is, as I stated earlier, the story of the birth of a nation. But in many ways, the nation existed before the crossing. Their coming out of the sea is their rebirth into a world order of shalom.